so much. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to a new standalone course. It's very exciting, isn't it? It's very exciting. Okay, for all those that have been pre-attendees, very, very good enhancement for what you need. For all those that are new or have skipped significant amounts, don't worry about it, because we really are starting a completely new section dealing with totally new kind of stuff. Now again, if you've been here previously, you'll be able to plug all that data into different things that we've learnt, etc., which will help and enhance knowledge. But if you've not dealt with this, let me tell you, this is very exciting. Usually these kind of topics which are discussed here are possibly only ever mentioned in passing by other... Yeah, can you shut... Is that cool? Can you shut... Oh, there's people. Human beings. They're gone now. So this kind of material is unusual, okay? People tend not to deal with this material in public, not because you have to be 40 years old to learn it. That's actually stuff in section 4, which I'll get to with you. this is actually not Kabbalah, but it's what people think of when they hear the word Kabbalah. When they say the word Kabbalah, they go, ooh, spooky stuff. This is what we're going to do. That's not actual Kabbalah. We'll talk about Kabbalah specifically later, it's more of a science. What we're going to do tonight, which is very exciting, is talk about things which you don't really hear about. And in order to aid you in the talking about things which you don't really hear about thing, I would like to pass out some, not actually pass out and fall on the floor, I don't mean that. I would like to pass around, there's two there, if you have a look. I'd like to pass out some of these sheets. We're getting more printed up. In fact, as long as I've got one, do you want to just maybe take one and pass along? And these are for you to keep. And we're going to need this because what we're going to do, please God, is discuss this first. So we're going to discuss this first and then we're going to go into the actual text. And I don't know if you saw the poster. Good evening. I don't know if you saw the poster, which was... Are you okay? Not good. Doesn't work. Ah, okay. We don't have it. Oh, okay. So...
Pretty crucial.
Is everyone at least got access to at least look at one? Can you share? If you two share, then maybe if I give Leslie's going to want one as well. If you two share, just how many people don't have? Can you just have a? Ooh, you don't have. Can I ask you two to share? I'm so sorry. I'm trying to make more copies. If I give you that, and you, do you have? No, you don't have. Can you pass one to Craig and down at the back? Oh, and we got Adrian as well. Okay, we're going to need more. But okay, we're. Can you share one between us? It's a bit much to share one between three. I think Adrian can share. Have you got one of those between two or between three? Yeah, you can all share that one? Okay, we're good. If anyone needs more, don't worry. What I want to talk to you now is about this piece of paper, which I've just given out, and a piece of paper which I'm not going to give out, which doesn't need to be given out, because it's just one idea, is this piece of paper, which I'm going to discuss with you. Okay, I'll discuss it with you now. Why not? I was going to discuss it with you later, but why not? Okay, everybody, we are going to talk tonight about the anatomy, actual anatomy, of a soul. It's really intense, right? I mean, how many times you get that, right? When's the last time you heard that discussed? A lot of people grew up thinking that their souls were a bit of God, right? It's a bit of God is with me. That's not true. Why is that not true? Because God doesn't have any anatomical structure whatsoever. And for those individuals that have been here previously, we've learned that God can't have any structure, even spiritual, whatsoever. Because he's completely simple. He's completely unified and simple. The soul has structure, as I've just given out to you, this form. It has structure. Anything which has structure can't be God. So the soul, which is very structured, as we're going to discuss, certainly isn't a bit of God. It is the most godly bit we've got. I'll give you that. It's godly, but it ain't God himself. That's a Jewish concept. I've heard that from a lot of Jewish people. They say that God is my soul and my soul is God. No, he isn't. He can't be. It's impossible. And what we're going to do now is use my fantastic telescope piece of paper. For those people listening on the tape, I've basically got a telescopic thing on a piece of paper, and it's got A, B, C, and D, with A being the big part of the telescope, B being smaller, C smaller, and D the very, very bit in the centre. All you need to do is have the... Oh, did you manage to get copies? Baruch Hashem. Anyone that doesn't have a copy, please put up their hands and turn all phones to silent or off, or leave them outside charging, or And certainly don't surf the internet while we're learning in here. Just have to throw that. Why not? I'll do that because I can at this juncture. Thank you so much, Sophie. I really appreciate it. Yes. Okay. As I say, I get a lot of you. I got quite a few emails last week, and I wrote back with quite a lot of in-depth thing, as Dobby mentioned. So if you do have questions, don't be afraid. If you're scared to put up your hand now, if I miss the opportunity to answer you now, email me, and I usually give back voluminous things with verse sources and everything like that, as you can ask people that. I'll just carry on, shall I? Now, I want to show you A, B, and C, D, A, B, C, and D on this, okay? Everyone has seen a telescope before. I don't mean a telescope, you look at the stars. Something telescopic, like an aerial. You've probably seen an aerial on a radio, or, you know, those radios are these old things from the 1900s where there's waves and you pick them up before iPads and things. It's called a radio aerial, and you can put it up, and you can put it down, and put it down, right? Now, very, very important, this idea. This is a Kabbalistic concept. We're going to dive straight into Kabbalistic concepts. Okay? There's something called Chitzonius and Panemius. Chitzonius is external and Panemius is internal. So in my body, the Chitzonius would be my skin and my hair. And the Panemius, if you're looking anatomically, physically, be things like my internal organs. Is everyone with that so far? So in and out. Just think of the words in and out. Is everyone okay with the word in and out? You'll see why we're going to need this in just a minute, but it's vital to get this down, so let's do it first. So, are you okay? You comfortable?
Yeah, I'm good. Just carry on.
Do you want one of these?
Nope.
Good?
So.
Do you want this envelope? You've got an envelope here. It says, is that what you want?
Yeah.
Okay, that's great. No, anything else? So you can have this magic, with a magic wheel. Do you want the magic wheel? Okay, we did that last week, I think, or the week before. Okay, now, let's think about this telescope. I want to talk to you about this telescope, extremely important idea. In my telescopic structure, I've got one cylinder with another cylinder popping out of it, okay? Let's just look at A and B. Once you've got A and B, C and D are just there for icing on the cake. Okay, can everyone see A and B, or at least has seen A and B? The outside of A, let's call it a metal aerial, is the chitzonius, is the outside. And the internality, the inside of A, which is the, slash or hatched area, which I've very crudely drawn there, is the internal bit of A. Does that make sense? Does everyone, hands up for anyone it doesn't make sense with. It all is making sense to me. There's not a single person that doesn't make sense to. Okay, then don't blame me when I just can run through this. Okay, now, outside of the inside bit of A comes B. Okay, B pops up from within A in a telescope. Is everyone comfortable with that? Now, the bit of B which is touching A, this is really important. The bit of B which is touching A is the outside of B. So the outside of B is only ever in contact with the inside of A. Is that clear to everyone? It's only the most external part of B which has any interface with the internal part of A. Is that making sense? Are you here for an envelope? Do you want your envelope? Dovey's got it. Okay, if I just say he'll come around again. Okay, so the most external part of B is touching the most internal part of A. Is everyone clear on that? This is how it would look. It would look like that. Obviously, for people listening, you're going to have to just trace, basically kind of imagine sections of a telescopic pole. Okay? And the outside of the next section of telescopic pole up is touching the inside of the one below it. I don't think I can say it any more clearly than that. Now, let's just get this straight. Let's get this really straight. The bit of C. C pops out from the inside of B, right? And the same thing happens again. The outside of C is only ever in intimate contact with the inside of B. Is that clear? And it just carries on and carries on and carries on, however many bits you'd make, however long the area will be. This whole system will carry on. So, okay, we're pretty much done with that. So the outside of something is the most coarse, the most, physically coarse, rough, sandpaperish area. And the internality of that, which is the refined spiritual upper bit, is the internality of that. Now, the next level up from that, the only thing it's touching is the spiritual bit, is the inside bit. As it comes up, now its most coarse element, the outside of B, is only ever touching the most refined level of A. Do you see that? So the outside of B would have nothing to do with the outside of A. The outside of A is disgusting. Plebeian. Common. I would never have anything to do. I would never be seen in the same restaurant as A. Do you understand that? But that's me. Here's the outside of B. It isn't as if us outsides stick together and they go out clubbing and things like that. A's and B's outside. We're all outsiders. The outside of B is so refined that it only even just touches the most internal part of A. Is that super clear? Now, the internal part of B, the top of B, the hatched part of the crushed part of B, is so refined that it is almost totally removed from the concept of A. Let alone the outside of A. It's just a diagram. You're flowing with the concepts, yeah? And it just carries on all the way up. So if you look at C, the most coarse physical bit of C is so far removed from A, it's like not even in the same world. The outside of C is like only ever touched the inside of B. And the inside of B thinks that the outside of A is a loser. Do you know what I'm saying? Is that super clear? Is this clear?
Yes. Late and it's very hot in here. It's very tiring. I know, it's very hot.
I'm going to put the telescope down and I'm going to pick up a picture of the anatomy of the human soul that I've just given out. Now, I'm not an artist that has sufficient ability to be able to link the telescope idea into this picture. But if I could, thank you so much, Ronnie. I don't want the ladies to get cold, but thank you so much. If I could, I would have done that. I would have said that this whole system is also telescopic, but I couldn't think of a way to draw that. If you get cold, please just do let me, is it really too cold? If I couldn't draw that and get that across in this picture. So let's have a look at this picture, okay? So this picture, for people listening on the tape, is called The Structure of the Human Soul. And I'm gonna try to speak it out with you. Now, if you've learnt any anatomy or physiology, as I know there are certain people in this room that have, the whole study of anatomy and physiology is only the study of the tray at the bottom of the page. That tray is the entire physical body. That's everything. That's your blood vessels, that's your bones, your sinews, your skin, your nervous system, the endocrine system, everything. Everything is in that tray. And that tray is a physical receptacle for what lies above it. Do you have a copy of this? Yeah, everyone? This tray at the bottom is the body. That's the body that we know, okay? It's designed just to be a receptacle for what we're going to put in it. Now, the first level above it is called, in our literature, the nephesh habahamis, okay? Which is translated as the animalistic soul. Now, it's called the animalistic soul because animals have one too. Doggies and catties and rabbits and things like that all have one of these animalistic souls. And these animalistic souls is the bit which is responsible for their consciousness. Their thinking, their feelings, whatever rationalization they have, anything like that is basically going on in the animalistic soul. It's all going on in the nefesh habahamis. Everything. Now, at the top of the nefesh habahamis, you'll see there's a certain jack plate, like a square bit kind of thing. Difficult to actually draw in, but I represented it as a square on top of that sphere. And that sphere is called the nefesh hasichlis, or literally intelligent soul, or soul of intelligence. It's often called human intelligence. Let me just clarify where we're at so far. The soul that dogs, cats, horses, whales, chimpanzees have is the most ethereal thing in the entire universe. When I mean ethereal, I mean it is the most incredible bit that is still physical. It's the most spiritual thing you can get that's still physical. But it is nonetheless purely physical. The soul that is animating a cat or a dog is actually genetically encoded. It's part and parcel of the genetic material that it inherited from its parents. Okay? But it is genetic. Now, could I think we've done this before. But as I have a genetic background, I know there's some people here who are trained in genetics or medicine, stuff like that. I'm going to ask you, how much of your genetic material that you have in your body, genes are the chemicals that tell your body to make your body, how much of that is actually used to make your body? How much of your genetic material? 5%. Okay, I've got 5%. Who hands up for 5%? 5%, big, go, go. 5%! That's not 5%?
2%,
3%. 2%, 3%. Oh, okay, so some people have been here before. Okay, so I'm just going to do this. And the, and the answer is 3%. Only 3% of your genetic makeup, only 3% is used to construct your entire human body. Now, know that your brain has more neural connections, more nerve connections in it than all the stars in the Milky Way. That's a lot. It's making a parallel computer, a computer wired in parallel, all in your brain. It's a supercomputer sitting in your skull that can process an incredible amount of data. We tend only to use approximately, they say, 8% of it. And all of that, including your toenails and your hair and your eyes and your knees and everything like that, is all encoded in just 3% of that genetic material, just 3%. Our sages teach us that the rest of that material, and he'll actually say it inside, especially in the notes, the rest of that material goes to encode the Nefesh HaBahamis, the animalistic soul. Brand new piece of data. Brand new piece of data. So in our actual bodies, and in our blood and our system, our cells, where there is a genetic code, 3% of that goes on your body, and 97% of that goes on higher functioning. Now, let's just get something really clear. I'm not sure what the most intelligent animal is in the world. I've seen research suggest it could be a chimpanzee. Some say it could be the white beluga whale. Now, the white beluga whale has been known, and this is documented, I'm not making this up, just picking it off my keypad, just throwing it out at you. Please do look it up, obviously not during the shear, but afterwards, using the power of Google, about white beluga whales. They have been known to pop their heads out of water and attempt to communicate with sailors on boats. So they pop their heads, they go, which means, hi, how are you? My name's Jerry, if you speak well. Now, if you think about that, that's an extremely high level of abstract thinking. Because if you're a fishy or whale or something like that in the water, what you're going to see of a boat is basically a shadow at the surface. And you may think that's a piece of driftwood or it's a fish or something like that. You wouldn't know, from the shape of that shadow, I know that that's actually a vehicle created by beings which inhabit that vehicle, and they are the masters of that vehicle. And those beings look like bipedal kind of monkey kind of things, and they run around, and then you can talk to them. If you think about how much, that's very advanced. And they pop out and go, hi, how are you doing? Nice to see you. Good fishing today. That's ridiculous. Now, whether they're the most intelligent or whether the chimpanzee is the most intelligent, I know that chimpanzees have been taught 200 words in facilitated communication sign language. 200 words using a board where they can say, I'm hungry, I'd like to play, I want to paint, and they can move symbols around, etc. And they can literally talk to the human interactors. It's absolutely phenomenal. Whether they're the most clever animal, whether the white beluga whale's most clever animal is a moot point. I don't know, and frankly, it's not important. The kasha is, how are they so clever? How is, now, beluga whales, let's say, are more clever than worms. Would everyone agree with that? I mean, worms are pretty, I don't know, they do their thing. But beluga whales are really clever. And chimpanzees are also, and they use tools and things like that. But how are beluga whales and so much more clever than dogs? Well, let's say they are. Let's say for argument's sake, Ms. Levinson, let's say for argument's sake they are more clever. Let's say that are look, whoever is more clever, you'd agree that some animals are more clever than others. Would you agree with that? So a mouse maybe isn't as clever as, I don't know, another. You would agree with that or you wouldn't agree with that? Yeah. Some animals are more clever than others. It doesn't matter which ones they are. Pick the ones you like. Pick the not clever animals, put them in a box. Pick the really clever animals, whichever ones you like, and put them in a box. Okay? Now, the kasha is, How are those animals clever?
The answer is because they have a more developed nefesh hasichlis. Now, the nefesh hasichlis is the top end of the nefesh bahamis. It's actually part of it. This nefesh bahamis, the animalistic soul, is the bit which is responsible for thinking, feelings, emotion, that kind of stuff. The top end of that, the highest function of the nefesh bahamis, according to Jewish thinking, is the nefesh hasichlis, is the intelligent element of that soul. And we almost consider that as a sub-area. Craig, is it making sense to everyone? So now, let's say a horse, which is aware of things, has a particularly developed nefesh hasichlis, the intelligent bit, but that nefesh hasichlis isn't as developed as you would get in a chimpanzee. And a chimpanzee, or a white beluga whale, their nefesh hasichlis is particularly well-developed for an animal. Now, all of this is all genetically encoded. Making sense? All genetic. So let's just have a look at now. Can you see there's a brace on the left-hand side where I've got what's genetically encoded? That's the guf, the entire physical body. That's 3% of genetic material goes into making that. Then you've got the nefesh bahamis, the animalistic soul, the top of which, the highest element, the highest fraction of that, is considered its own domain, even though it's really part of nefesh bahamis. And that's called the nefesh hasichlis. The way I like to think about it, just because I may use this in future, is cabling for your telephones. I assume you've all seen cabling for telephones, right? At the end of your cabling for telephones is something you can plug in. Yeah, that's called a jack plug. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's a little plasticky thing with little metal bits and stuff like that. Do you know what I'm talking about? You put that in the wall and then you can get phone lines. It's amazing. Does everyone know what I'm referring to here? Now, if you think about the cable as being the nefesh bahamis and the jack plug bit being the nefesh hasichlis, because it's that bit which interfaces with a higher order. That's the bit of the wire that you stuff into the jack plug, and then you can connect to a massive network which is hidden from view. That's just a moshel, it's just an analogy, but I'm going to come back to that and use that a lot. Is that Clive?
Just one question. Where do you get your assumption that the nefesh have a hammer? Is actually within that 97% of the gene, which is not identical.
Because it says so in the sources. It says it's given over in the seed from the parents.
But genetic coding was only recently been discovered.
But Torah hasn't been recently discovered.
No.
So because the Torah talks about this, it actually talks about genetic coding and letters that are involved in it. It actually talks about this way before Watson and Crick came along. So we've got a tremendous amount of data on this, which is literally mind-blowing. And I mean that in the full sense of the term. I very rarely... It's literally mind-blowing. The whole concept of genetics and coding and codes inside which make things happen is very much a Torah concept. Codes inside things. So we've been talking about this for thousands of years. Had we stood on a soapbox in Regent's Court, you know, Hyde Park Corner, whatever it is, and says, all of our bodies are made up of letters that are... They're just thinking nuts. There's lots of things like that, but... I mean, Judaism said the world was as round as a ball 3,500 years ago. Okay, so come on, brachos. And we knew that as part of our tradition, but if the whole world was guaranteeing that it was flat, otherwise what would happen? I mean, all lakes would spill out and everything. How could it possibly be round? Because of gravity or pulling, it's very complicated. But the point is, we know that. Okay, it's every... Dr. Sid.
Provocative.
It's okay. I quite like it, whatever you mean.
So, what you're saying is, if I understand correctly, that the soul resides in every cell of the body, because every cell has got a chromosomal makeup.
No, it doesn't.
Which ones don't?
You tell me, which cells don't have chromosomal input at all? You couldn't live if they did.
You got me.
Oh, goodness, I couldn't have got you on this. Have I? Every single red blood cell has no nucleus.
You're correct.
Right? There are many things that there's certain elements of the body that... Don't think of it where the chromosomes are. It's what the chromosomes create. There's art everywhere in the world, but not in every room is there a picture. Hear me out.
Yes.
You don't have to say that the soul is residing inside the chromosomes. Chromosomes are just a code. It's like a seed, okay? But when that seed has blossomed into consciousness, I said it's the most ethereal thing still in the physical world. It's hardly bound by physicality. We don't know how to exactly define consciousness today. That's a big argument. When is someone truly dead? Using brainstem death tests, etc. But what's consciousness?
Could you be conscious without the brainstem? There's a whole level of consciousness that we can't really define. That's a big area in psychology. Whether you want to argue biopsychology-wise, whether you want to argue it existentially on the other side. The point is that what it produces from a physical seed is not actually contained within it. That makes sense, right?
Yes.
The flowers of apple blossom are not in that same seed that was on the ground, right? It came from another seed. Okay? So it's not inside the cells. It's generated from that genetic material.
So if you've got some cells with genetic material...
Then you're good to go. It'll generate it.
So
depending upon the code.
If someone has a leg chopped off, that doesn't make any difference.
Of course it won't.
A whole lot of
That's fine. I've got cells in my eyelashes. As long as something's growing somewhere in a good environment and it develops correctly in the womb, then you're good to go.
One other question, sorry, to take over.
Okay, let's hear what it is.
Four
questions, four new people. I've got my cot bell. Cot is completely off topic. And if I get a question that I don't want to answer, I do that and say completely off topic and reserve the right not to answer the question. Isn't that great? It's unbelievable because I can do that, right? Yeah.
Of ascribing animal intelligence to the presence of the soul, the animalistic soul, could animal intelligence not merely be a feature of brain size? A dog's got bigger brain than
a cat. If it's a case of brain size, Dr. Sid, blue whales should be running the world.
Very large brains, yes.
They've got very large. Yeah. In fact, they have the largest brain. And manta rays have the largest brain of any fish. But they're not ruling the seas either. Brain size is not a Neanderthal man had larger cubic centimetre volume of brain size than we do. So clearly, that's not corollary. And indeed, that's a very difficult thing to answer from a scientific basis. They don't know how this works. Really, if you think about if we, in our brains, have more neural connections than all the stars in the Milky Way, how many neural connections are there in the blue whale brain? 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 galaxies? They just stop and think, wow, I could turn back gravity like this. And they'll just change the world. We're like, wow, blue whales are cool. They have the biggest brains. But it's not down to brain size. Clearly, there's something more than you can get in the physical world. And that's where we're going next. Is everyone comfortable to go further with me, yeah? You get comfortable, got everyone happy? Questions? Let's go back to the picture. We have now dealt with and finished with the physical bit. The physical bit is the body and the consciousness element, which is the Nefesh Bahamas, according to the Jewish teaching, animalistic soul. Again, I'm not trying to tell you what to believe. I'm not trying to tell you what to accept. I just want you to know what Judaism has to say about it. That's all, okay? That is all I'm doing. I'm explaining to you the legacy of that knowledge, okay? Do what you want with it, but at least you know it clear. Okay, so the Nefesh Bahamas, and the top of that Nefesh Bahamas, the jack plug, as it were, the open, we're just going to click into something else, which is not dependent upon the size of how big the jack plug is, but a whole network that it's going into. It's called the Nefesh Yisichlis. That's the intelligent aspect. Humans happen to be the most endowed with intelligence of all the creatures, and they're going to need that because their Nefesh Yisichlis, their jack plug, has a lot to plug into. Let's now go into the realm of the spiritual. That was a nice little break there. Here we go. We're now going to the spiritual realm, which is not bound by genetics. It's not now, obviously, it's affected by it because if someone has dodgy genetics, they're not going to be able to jack plug correctly. And that may even have effects on whether or not they should keep mitzvahs or not. Women have different genetics to men. Would everyone agree with that? Yeah. Women have different mitzvahs to keep than men. Kohanim and Levim have been shown to have different genetics to Yisraelim, to Israelites. You aware of that? It's been studied in London. There's a whole thing about the lady studies. Kohanim and Levim are missing certain genetic markers. And Kohanim miss more than Levim. How? Interesting. There's genetic differences. Indeed, Kohanim are different by dint of birth, not merit. You notice that? I was born a Kohanim because my dad was Kohanim, his dad was Kohanim. So what can I do? I'm a Kohanim. Well, good, you've got to go Duchenim. But why am I Duchenim? I don't have any more. No, you do. It's a genetic thing. You're genetically different. Because you're genetically different, you're plugging in with a slightly different connection point on that Nefesh Yisichlis bit. Let's talk about the plug-in bits. Now, don't forget that the telescope rule still applies. Let's actually start labelling it. Remember the telescope, everybody? that A on the outside will be your physical body. That's your physical body, right? In fact, I'm going to say the whole physical body, including the internal organs, just to make life easier. The inside of A, the panemius, the inside, the internality is Nefesh HaBahamis. It's the animalistic soul. That's the most refined element of the physical body. You can't get, it's the super ethereal. They'll actually say that black and white. I'm not making it up. That's the most ethereal part. Our consciousness is the most ethereal part of our being. It's certainly the most refined part. Our toenail cuttings are certainly not as refined as our higher thoughts. Do you agree with that? That makes sense, right? But the toenail cuttings is in the area of A, and our higher thoughts about art and culture and freedom and liberty are all in the hatched bit of the inside of A. That's the Nefesh Bahamas, right? And the top, the most internal, the most core part of that, just touching the outside of B, will be the Nefesh HaSichlis. Is everyone getting this in the concept of a telescope? What's B? B is something we haven't discussed yet. B, spiritual. What differentiates humans from animals? A massive question, this. What's different from a human and animal? Humans can talk. That is the most clear, even though other creatures, such as beluga whales and elephants, communicate all the time in infrasound, which are sound waves. They're very chatty, apparently. Chatty beings, elephants. They communicate by bellowing their bellies. And they're actually communicating in sound waves which are so low that human ears can't hear them. So they sound very quiet when they're walking down the road, or like holding each other's tails and stuff like that. But actually, they're chatting the whole time. And if you put a special microphone which can hear it and then translate it, move it up to a human pitch, they're talking the whole time. So lots and lots of, it's a bit of a stop fact there. Next time you're under like a table or something, I've got a piece of trivia. Elephants communicate in infrasound. It's like, and bats use ultrasound, right? It's really interesting, yeah? But at the end of the day, they don't talk. There's lots of communication. We can even see the seeds of certain language within animals, but nothing even beginning to be the complicated utilization of language by human beings. There is no, would you like, I see that someone in the crowd for the tape is not at all happy with that. Why don't you, let's talk about
it. How do we know it's not as evolved as ours? I mean, the way we move our mouths, and the way they move theirs, how can we?
Human communication has driven the human alliance to be able to do things which no other creature on earth can do. And the only way we can do that is through an extremely advanced, replete lexicon, where we understand each other, can communicate the most abstract ideas to each other in many different ways. Maths, pure maths, explaining pure, teams in Japan liaising with teams in London who are liaising with teams in New York on the most complicated area of pure maths, utilising concepts of sigma and theta, which are the weasel words, really. They've been sucked out of, what is a theta? Is just a letter in the Greek alphabet, and it means so much more. And the concept that everyone's got a unified code, which they're talking about, look, landing, rockets on meteors and things like that, means they have to understand very complicated elements of gravity, which is a very abstract thing. You don't find Douglas sitting around going, this is fantastic, this talking thing. Let's take over the world and then make tanks. You don't get that because they aren't able to communicate on that level. I think that's fair to say. Has anyone got a problem with what I'm saying? You'd like to argue it out or stop me mid-flow?
But they can still say, like the elephant said to her, you're thirsty.
I don't know. No, they're certainly communicating, but I don't know if that's an anthropomorphism. That's a personification of elephants. I'm thinking what an elephant would say to each other. I'm not saying, are you thirsty, and with a preposition and a question, and they may just say water there, or what words are we... My language is so much higher than elephants. For me to tell you what elephants are saying, I'm already giving you non-truths, because elephants don't talk the way I talk. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Thankfully, they're not Cockney. Because you're like, oh, there's a couple of lines down there. Lovely lines. Couple of zebras too. Could you imagine? God, my goodness, and all these people with like microphones. Elephants are speaking with a Cockney accent. It's like, a huge thing with David Attenborough. And it turns out elephants are actually from East London. Okay, so really, oh, they're from savannas in Africa. Okay, how did I get there? I don't know, Cockney elephants. But that was good, wasn't it? Cockney elephants. You won't hear that anywhere else. Cockney elephants? Pretty good. Oh, there's a question coming in. Yeah.
I only wanted to say that there is a high level of communication with different animals, like, you know, ants, bees. Mm. Amazing.
Bees dance. Bees dance in figure eights. And we've worked out what that dance means to tell you that by the position of the sun and their wiggling of their abdomens, they're telling you nice flowers are over there. And when it's time to swarm, they come back and vote. They vote and say, we found a good place over there, there's a good place over there. And the more bees say, let's go over there, the more likely it is of a swarm. There's definite communication.
So I would say that one of the biggest differences between the humans and the animals is that animals don't have free will, whereas humans do.
Let's not talk about free will. Let's talk right now, we're talking about communication. We just Mrs. Graham said speech.
What was the difference?
No, but the main difference, one of the main, for an alien coming down to Earth and coming out of his source or whatever it is, looking around, it'd say, there are lots of creatures in the world, but there are bipedal creatures who are the main life form on Earth, or have the dominant life form. And the most important thing about them that's different is they communicate very abstract thoughts through speech. And even though there's lots of creatures talking and communicating in lots of different ways, they have not gained the kind of lexicon which gives them this amazing level of prowess and dominance by being able to create such abstract concepts. We would have thought if they've also made a flying saucer to be able to get, let's say, across the galaxy, they could also communicate via an extremely high level to build such a contraption. You don't generally find dogs and horses getting together saying, let's make a jet, you know, like a jet plane together.
Isn't that because they're thick, though?
It's not because they're thick. They don't have the prerequisite jack plate to be able to get to the higher levels that we're about to discuss. I think I'm going to call it. One more question then I'm going to call it. It doesn't matter. Even if it's the best question in the world, it's the next one. I'm not going to do it.
I thought people like David Attenborough say that the difference between humans and animals is the fact that we are the tool makers.
That's not true, because rooks make amazingly complicated. They'll whittle down twigs and they'll craft, if they've got a complicated puzzle to get through different straws, they'll put different twigs together and make a unique tool which can only be solved for that particular puzzle. In which case, they should be ruling the world. Clearly that's not the case. Rather than look to David Attenborough et al and his mate to tell you what the difference between humans and animals are, I'm going to go to the Ari HaKadosh. Okay? And we'll see what they say. But again, you're free to do whatever you want at your own time and leisure and DVDs and BBC Wildlife programmes, do whatever you want. Woo! Here we go. The next sphere, which is point B on our telescope, is the Ruach. The Ruach, which is Hebrew for the word spirit or wind, breath. Notice in Genesis, when God says he created man, it says he blew life into his nostrils. And this term of ruach, which is a spirit or wind of spirituality, which God blew into the nostrils of Adam Arishan, is not physical. When Adam was created, he was literally put together by clods of earth. That's why his name is Adam. It's Adama. Literally means of the soil. He's literally a clod of earth that was animated. Just like a doggy. Someone asked me in one of these emails. I get a lot of emails, right? One email I got a tag. This is great. And so just may save you from having to write me this email. Goodness, I was just about to tell you that, but I'm not allowed to use it here, so I couldn't tell you. He was a dog lover, this bloke, and he had lots of dogs, and one of his dogs died, and he very much viewed the dog as an extension of his family. Apparently people in Britain tend to see their dogs as a member of their family. That doesn't happen in China. They tend to see their dogs as a member of the menu. But in England, they tend to see the dogs, it's true, unfortunately, they tend to see the dogs as an actual full-fledged member of the family with their own rights and privileges. Now, this dog died, and he was very upset about it. And he wrote in and said, in memory of my dog, would I be allowed to recite Kaddish for a year in shul in order to, as a memory of the dog? Now, that may seem whimsical to most of you, but then every one or two go, you actually don't really like my dog. And I've got a dog, and I would be upset if the dog would die, of course. You would miss the affection and the love that you have for that pet, absolutely. But can I say Kaddish for my dog? That's the kasha. Now, what is a dog? What is a human being? The truth is they share a tremendous amount of similarity if you look at it anatomically. They both have a goof. They both have the tray at the bottom of this picture. They both have a physical body. They both, humans and dogs, have a nefesh bahamis, an animalistic soul, which gives them consciousness, and they know where their bones have been hidden in the garden, and they know who the local smells are on the lampposts. So that's Jerry, and that's Fred, and that's Bill, and oh, there's a new dog in town, right? And they can figure that out. And that's clear. You need to. And they have a level of nefesh asichlis. I think an amazing thing is guide dogs. These creatures are unbelievably well trained. They can take on a tremendous amount of personal human data and work as in seeing. In America, it's seeing eye dogs, which I particularly like. That it's called a seeing eye dog. Especially the eyes. These are incredibly trained creatures. Now humans are also sharing those three things, but the dog will not stand up and recite Shakespeare because he can't. He can just bark, which is a form of communication for that dog. But it isn't speaking. The gift of speech is a divine gift. Before you have a glass of water or any food, which is an instant, like drink, most drinks, there's a bracha shahakol nihiyeh bidvaroi, that we bless Hashem, saying thank you, King of the universe, who creates everything with his word. There's a Gemara that says av bara kadavar bara. The Father creates as his word creates. The Gentiles took this, translated it, av bara kadavar bara, as abracadabra, the quintessential magic word. Abracadabra. Av bara kadavar bara. The Father creates the way he speaks. Again, coming back to your point about how do you make a rocket, the first thing we're going to have to do, if you're not going to make a rocket, is talk about it. In whose garden are we going to launch it? What's the insurance? Do we have clearance with the airline authorities that we can shoot something 12,000 feet up into the sky with a camera on the end and bring it down? Can we do that? That will take talk. We'll have to sit and talk about that. Then you've got to buy rocket stages possibly and motors and fins. And is it a big thing? You can't create a project that advanced without talking about it. The thing which directly plugs into the Nefesh HaSichlis is the Ruach, which is a spiritual concept which gives us the power of speech. I've got to tell you an amazing thing. There is one exception of a talking animal. Has anyone come across an animal which can talk the way I'm talking to you now?
Parrots.
Parrots. They can't talk the way I'm talking to you now, like in free speech. They're not going to mimic and go, who's your pretty boy? Who's your pretty boy? I can't believe I just did that. I don't know how many people have done that in the space of Medrash, but now I've done it. You say, who's a pretty boy? And he goes, who's a pretty boy? He's very carefully mimicking. What about an animal, I don't know, a whale that goes, hello, good evening, how are you? Are you enjoying it here? What do you think? What do you think it's doing? Everyone cool? You like refreshments outside? Could you imagine an animal talking to you like that? Has that ever happened in history? Yes, it has. Balaam's donkey. God on Erev Shabbos, says the Mishnah, had to busy himself making the mouth of the donkey. That's the donkey, Balaam's donkey, which had to be made with a certain unique musculature in order to be able to enunciate speech, which donkeys don't have. And then when Balaam was actually riding the horse, the donkey, do you know something happened? There was an angel that stood opposite it, and it moved left and right. It wanted to get out of the way. It was terrified. He could see the angel, but Balaam couldn't. He could see more of a revelation of what was going on than this rusher that was on his back, right? On her back, actually. So when that happened, Chazal tell us, God invested that donkey with a ruach. He had to, because that's the system. That's how he does it. There's no other way to do it within the system. That's how he does things. So he gave that donkey a ruach in order that maybe when the donkey actually addresses Balaam and says, what are you doing? Why hit me like that? Then he'll do tshuva. Maybe he'll repent from his evil ways. Particularly wicked man was Balaam. But apart from that incredible exception which is mentioned, donkeys tend not to turn around and talk to you. That's because they don't have a ruach. The ruach is specifically the spirit of speech. Now that ruach is part B in our telescope. Now think about this. The outer, most coarse level of the spirituality of the Ruach only ever interfaces with the highest inner point, which is the Nefesh HaSichlis of the Nefesh Bahamis, which is the hatched area.
And that, only the edge of that, is touching our body. Where would you find the Nefesh, Bahamas, and Sichlis most intensely concentrated? In the brain. Very, very good. Specifically, the higher part of the brain, the cerebral cortex. That's where you get the reasoning. That's generally where the Nefesh Bahamas sits. And we have a tradition that the soft part of the head, the fontanelle, which in babies doesn't close, is actually a gateway. That's the jack point between the Nefesh, Sichlis, and the Ruach. Notice, Jewish men place the tefillah shel rosh, the head tefillin, that's plural already, the head tefillah, one tefillin, is called a tefillah, it's called a prayer. They're prayer boxes. That's placed right there, the jack point. And we re-energize that jack point. Men need to re-energize that regularly. Okay? Is everyone comfortable about that so far? Any questions? No? So far, so good. Is everyone okay?
What do you mean by re-energize?
I could get onto that later. Okay. Yeah, I have to get onto that because that's a whole discussion about what tefillin actually meant to do, why they're placed on. So one is opposite the heart, which is a seat of emotion. One's opposite the head, which is the seat of intellect. We'll talk about why both of those need to be channeled in men more regularly than they do with women. That's a whole thing, a really interesting thing that's later on. I'd love to discuss that, but I'll get dragged off and we've only got limited time. People complain. Okay, right, so that was A and B. What we're now going to do, which is what most people think about when they hear the word soul, is talk about sphere 3 on our magic sheets. This is talking about anatomy of the soul. Is everyone clear about this? So you don't have a copy of this. Do you have a copy of this? You do? Fantastic. Sphere 3. This is called the Neshama. The Neshama. This is what we call a human soul. The word Neshama literally means breath. Breath. Okay? Everyone clear so far about... Yeah, very good. There's one of them. Very, very good. It's breath. Okay? Now, can you see I've got a dotted line on the sheet? There is a dotted line on the sheet. That dotted line makes a very clear separation between the upper and the lower spiritual components of a human soul. Now remember, if we're on this sheet over here and we're saying A is the physicality, the inside of A is a Nefesh Bahamas and Nefesh Sichlis. B is the Ruach and the internality of the Ruach. C, which is the outside part of the Neshama now, is making contact only the inside part of the Ruach. And they're going up now from C are bits so lofty that the A, which is the body, has absolutely no practical outcome of the connection with D and E whatsoever. Whatsoever. I'm just going to give you an analogy. Can I give you an analogy? Here's an analogy. I'm going to come back to this analogy. So I'm going to give it to you now, seed it out, and then I'll come back and just say, it's the ATM analogy. And you go, oh yeah, it's the ATM analogy. Okay, here's my ATM analogy, an automatic teller machine, a bank machine. You know what I'm saying? One of those things in the back. You want to take £10 out of a bank machine. That's what you want to do. So you got your card, and you put it in the machine, and you go boop, 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 you put your numbers in, and then it goes and it pops you out a £10 note. And you've now got this £10 note, right? Let's call that the Nefesh Bahamas. And the £10 note is the goof. You with me so far? How did that £10 note get there? Right, someone had to load the machine with what amounts to very expensive copy paper. Okay, it's £10 a sheet. Okay, so they're loading out £10 a sheet and they put in a card and go whoop, like that. Paper's very, very expensive. And then they go, how did they get all that? They've got to get like stacks of hundreds and hundreds of £10 notes, right? Where do you get all those £10 notes from? Well, the bank has it because it's a bank. That's what it does. So that stage of loading the machine is a level of ruach. You don't care as long as it's there, right? As long as you get your £10 out, you're a happy bunny. But how now, guys, you're with me here, yeah? How did the bank get their £10 notes?
I gave them
£10. So you gave them £10 when you opened an account and everyone else opened an account and that gave them £10. And then, but what did they do with that £10? They didn't put it in the machine. They lent it to someone, right? At interest, usually, right? And with that money, they went and on the stock exchange and made more money. And that's the money they're cashing in on to load the machine. Is everyone with me so far?
Yeah.
Yeah? So that's the level of neshama. Do you really care about, when you get your £10 note, whether or not the Stockton shares are high? You just want to make sure that machine delivers your £10 note. What do you care whether Barclays was investing in oil or in tobacco? Do you care? I need my £10 because I want to go out and I need to pay for something. Is that clear? But the stocks and the shares can fluctuate in ways which are completely illogical. You can't predict it. Out of all the years of studying economics, we cannot stabilize markets. You can't do it. And economists will tell you, I'm learning economics because eventually we can master what's going on and stabilize world economy. Well, that's nonsense, because you haven't been able to for 1,000 years. You just can't do it. Remember when Rupert Murdoch's daughter died, the stocks in all of his companies just fell. What's one thing got to do with another? What's one thing got to do with another? The point is that once something happens, something illogical, that is a level of chai or yechido or nashah. What do you care? You just want your £10. This is the ATM analogy. The ATM analogy is the bottom line is I want something in my hand. I want some physicality in my hand, whatever that is. But to get that physicality there, there were so many complicated things going on in the world to get that £10 to come out of that machine. You have no idea how that £10 got there. There were boardroom meetings. Should we invest in that? Maybe we should, I don't know, go to China and have a meeting with him. And they said, yeah, let's do that. Then finally they got all the money to get in the city. So you could get that, so you could go out that night. Are you with me so far? That's crazy amount of data. Crazy amount of work. Yeah? Does that make sense? That's true, right? I mean, how else are we going to get £10 there? But you couldn't care less. And if someone even told you about it, it would be like mind-boggling. The higher levels of the soul are as follows. And they don't descend into this world. We're connected to it by the network fiber system, but the neshama is part D. Have we got that? Or C? C. And the neshama itself is energized by the chaya, the life force of the soul. And that in itself has its own unique spiritual fingerprint, which is what gives your soul its unique identity by the yechida, which is the unique spiritual identity of that soul. Now the whole thing as a chain, the yechida, the chaya, the neshama, the ruach, the nefesh ha-sichlis, and the nefesh ha-bahamis, ignoring the guf, is what we refer to when we say a soul. When we say a soul, really we're not being particular. It's like, you know what? It's like me saying it's Dr. Sid's body, right? I'm just saying it's his body. But I'm not referring to his ankles, his knees, his hips, his torso, his skull. They have different bits, right? I just say it's his body. It's generally his body. That's it. It's clothed, finished. I don't go into specifics. The soul is not just one component. The soul is all of these components combined. And that one chain to which we're connected is considered a unique human soul. That's it. That is it. That's a soul. When we say, oh, it's his soul. Now, we're not saying what part of his soul. Generally, when people refer to the term soul, especially when Jews refer to the term, oh, it's his neshama, they're actually referring to the neshama, which is this breath bit, which is the link between the upper and the lower elements. Often what they mean is neshama. But often people make a mistake and they refer to the nefesh as the neshama. They refer to the animalistic soul as the spiritual, unique human soul. And that's not true. Now, coming back to the bloke that wrote in to me by email and said, please can I say Kaddish for my dog? What's the Jewish answer?
Ask a competent rabbi.
Well, I don't know. He asked a rabbi. I don't know the word. I mean, someone says I'm competent. I don't know. Whatever. He asked someone. He did what he could. Now, let's look at a dog. And let's look at a human being. There are a lot of candles and name plaques in this room. People that aren't in the room, they're listening on tape. And these are yard site name plaques. When it's their yard site, they turn on the candles and they say Kaddish and stuff like that. What are they saying Kaddish over? The first part of that question is to understand what Kaddish is. Kaddish is a prayer for what exactly?
For their unique spiritual identity.
Right. It's a prayer that praises Hashem in the merit of a deceased soul. And the deceased soul lives on in an environment that we call Olam HaNeshamos, the world of souls, which is a holding zone, a warehouse for human souls that have been through this world. It's a holding zone. And what we're doing is praying that hopefully that soul is in good shape. That's what the Kaddish prayer is. Yeah? That's the Kaddish prayer. What about a dog? What about a dog? If you say Kaddish over a dead dog, what is actually a dog? What is a dog? I don't mean, don't tell me it's a canid and it goes woof and it likes pedigree charm. What actually is on this sheet a dog? Physical. What do we got? Okay, we got a goof. Tick. Let's tick that. Yeah. What else?
Animalistic
soul. It's got the Nefesh Bahamas. Yeah, good. And it's got a Nefesh Sichlis, which is unique to dogs. Yeah, everyone good with that so far? Very, it's an animated clod of earth. So's my body. So's my body. Notice the physical element of the human body when the soul and the body disengage from each other is put back in the soil. God said, from dust you are, to dust you return. That's what he said to him. But that's that bit, from dust to dust. That's the way you go. That's not the soul. Raj says right there, that's one of the proofs that the soul is, it lives on. The physical bit indeed goes into the ground. Now, a dog has only got that physical bit. So a dog, as beautiful and as wonderful and as cuddly and as well-trained as a guide dog, only is an animated clod of earth with an extremely ethereal component called a Nefesh Bahamas, the most ethereal of all physical components that there is in the universe. But when it dies, it's genetic encoding, which at the end of the day is a physical chemical. Deoxyribonucleic acid, which is DNA, is just a long chemical which replicates itself. That's an incredible thing. How come other chemicals don't just do? Can you imagine salt? It's replicated itself. You just tip out some salt in the restaurant and then boop, replicate. Oh, just made more. That's meiosis for you. That's incredible. How did you do that? Well, yeah, we're chemicals as well. How about this very long chemical makes more of itself? Now, when the dog dies, for whatever reason, through trauma or old age or whatever it is, all those physical components just return to the physicality from which it came. So to say Kaddish over a dog is appellating and giving the Ruach, Neshama, Chaya, Yechida elements, which would live on and require that prayer, to something which doesn't have it.
Can it not be a reincarnation?
Even if a dog is a reincarnation. Okay, very crazy spiritual question coming in, which is great because it's the mysticism course. What happens if a dog is a reincarnation of a human? Very, very incredible question. The bit of that human that was reincarnated sitting in that goof, which is not... I've got to tell you something unbelievable. Okay, it's asking an amazing question. I'm going to go off and I want to come back. You're going to love this. You're going to love this. Something very, very important. You're asking a brilliant question. I'm going to go off. Okay. I'm going off. Okay, here I am. I'm here now. Certain punishments for certain sins are mentioned in the Torah. And I want to give you this as a cloud goddle, an important rule, so you understand wherever you see this in the Torah. It's very, very important what I'm going to tell you. You can use this yourself to explain things to other people. Really cool tools. Really important. It also shows how part of a system. God says like this. If you get an animal, a cow, and you slaughter the cow, it was a Gentile practice to actually collect the blood that spurts out of the incision of Shechita. Some tribes will even actually put their mouths to the part of the cow or animal that they're slaughtering and suck the blood out of the wound as it goes. And if you ask them, so there's something very special about it. And the truth is, there is. We're going to talk about this. One of the elements which carries around a certain part of the soul is the lifeblood. Ever heard the term lifeblood?
Yeah.
What is lifeblood? Lifeblood refers to the arterial blood which is being pumped out of the heart directly around the body. That's the oxygenated, clean blood. In that element, a certain element of the Nefesh Bahamas resides. Spiritual concept. Now, there's an Aveira, a specific sin, which we're told not to do. It's a mitzvah not to do it. That says, if you're going to slaughter an animal, and then you put your mouth, or you collect that into a container, and then drink that blood, not the blood which is residing in the musculature, after you butcher the animal, there's blood all in the muscles. That's forbidden for a Jew to eat that blood. But that blood does not carry the same penalty as actually sucking the lifeblood from the Beis Shechita, from the actual point of the slaughter incision. If an individual does that, the punishment is none other than kores, spiritual excommunication. One of, if not the most, severe punishments, eating on Yom Kippur knowingly. Could possibly also do that as well, depending upon certain situations. As bad as you could get. What on earth has that got to do with spiritual excommunication? Let me explain something to you. This is awesome. You're going to love it. If there's a part of the life force of that animal coming out in that blood at that time, and then you, not you, someone drinks and suckles from that blood. It seems a totally disgusting thing to do. There's a spirituality involved to it. What's happening is, by eating that blood, you are ingesting that cow, goat, sheep, whatever it is, life force into your body. Now hold on. Hold on. That cow, sheep, or goat is an animated clod of earth, right? I mean, now, a Yiddish Neshama, let's call him, I don't know, give me a nice Yiddish name. Adam, okay? Let's post-Torah. Can we go post-Torah? Moshe! Chaim! Yecheskel! Something like Adam. Okay, that's the most general human name. Now, this Yecheskel, or whatever his name is, or Shaltiel. Let's go really out there. Shaltiel. This bloke, it has all of this. He's a fully functioning Jew, right? That's what he's got. And suddenly, in a bizarre religious practice, he decided to imbue the lifeblood of an animal as it's being poured out by the contraction of the ventricle and aorta of the heart of that animal. It's being spewed out of there, and he's gulping it in. What's pouring into his stomach, into the guf, is a nefesh bahamis of a cow. Now, these bits are jackplate specific. Remember I talked about jackplates a bit? I already said it. I'm going to get it. I'll come back to it. You remember we talked about jack plates with the wires BT, and at the end there's a little placky thing, and you put the plastic thing in the jack plug, and that's got some connectors. The specific connectors for human beings connect with all these things at the top. If you throw a cow soul into that, the top bit disengages out of repulsion. It's like an opposite magnetic force. And these bits rescind up. Now, the bloke's not going to die. He's not going to just drop dead. The fact that all these upper spiritual levels are leaving him, specifically the Neshama, Chaya, and Yechida, recoil away from the Ruach, which is still tightly bound to Nefesh HaSichlis, means that he'll walk around and be able to speak. But he's literally suffered spiritual excommunication. That's what spiritual... Isn't this if God... Some people think that God is the bogeyman residing under the stairs, waiting to get you. He's like, you know, don't eat pork. You sit there like, ha ha, gotcha. You should, ha ha, now I've got, not like that at all. He's described to us a system of methodology that we exist in. He's told us, look, this is the structure of your soul. This is a system, this is it. This is how you're built, I built you. You're not me, I built you as a thing. This is you. If you subject you to certain spiritual and or physical things at certain times, the top bits won't maintain good connectivity. It's almost like electronics. It's like electronics. And if you do this, it'll just go like domino rally out. So the Torah reports, that's called kores. That's called spiritual communication. Not that God did it to you. It happens as a natural consequence of doing that particular act.
and you operate and live your life in a system where these acts happen. So the Torah says don't do that, because if you do that, the result is this. And it's revealing to us the system. Listen, if God said, look, okay, I'll open a book of random, you know, random attributed punishments. Right, what have you done? You've drunk cow blood. That's not going to cut off your soul. Why would you do that? Could we maybe talk about that? No, that's I made that. No, that's a system to allow this to operate. And if you do this, it breaks it. Does everyone at least understand that bit of it? Lee, you've got your hand up there.
Presumably, teshuva can reverse.
Teshuva, repentance, is a special thing which is created prior to the creation of man to allow a reversal of this if correctly applied. Yes, you can always polish up a rusty jack and reconnect it and put it back in. Yeah, it works. That's absolutely correct. But in the meantime, doing this results in that. It's just a system. Why didn't you create a car that it wouldn't be able to drive? It's ridiculous. That's how the soul's... That is a system of the soul. That's how the soul's made. It's delicate. It's fragile. Yeah.
It seems a bit unfair to some cultures. Like, I think some... The Maasai tribes.
They're not bound by the Torah. I mean, this is mentioned in the Torah. For Jews.
Right.
For Jews. The Maasai aren't allowed to do it because they're not allowed to eat from a live animal. That's a universal human law. That's not unfair to them. They're unfair to themselves, not obeying the seven Noahide laws. Hear what I'm saying there. It isn't as if, look, I've been doing this for 1,000 years, therefore I'm right. And because I'm right, you coming along and telling me the seven Noahide law says you're not allowed to eat something from a live animal is wrong, somehow is insulting to my culture. I'm not insulting your culture. I'm telling you that God has given to Adam the 6 Adamic laws, which was added to at Noah's time to the 7 Noahide laws after he saved the animals. He said, right, one thing I want you to do is no cruelty to animals. One way of doing that is not eating from a live animal. That's a universal human law given to all humanity. The fact that you don't apply to that is their problem. I'm not insulting them.
Okay, but if a culture doesn't know from Adamite laws or Noahide laws, mm-hmm. wouldn't know the Torah from the number 92 bus, and they and drink the blood. So do they then suffer this disconnection?
How that works with them is...
ignorance.
It could, yes, it's like this. If a person through ignorance makes a soldering connection or electricity connection that would electrocute them, you'd say, I'd suffer years and years and years of bad education, and they never went to school, and the school became corrupt, and then and they didn't go to electronics courses, and all the soldering irons were smuggled in by the Russian mafia, and none of them worked, and they all wired them up with wrong fuses. And this poor kid called Boris, who gets one in Slovakia, he plugs one in, and the fuse bursts and electrocutes him. Well, that's unfair to his culture, because what can he do? Because no one taught it. It's Boris's duty to do his very best to find out what the right thing to do is, and there are always channels to find that out. That's a very big question. I can't go further in that, but that's the bottom line with that.
Fine.
And that's the last question. Now, hold on. Why did I... Now, I'm coming back. Whew, that was a detour. Now, to talk about a 92 bus. That was like an open-top bus tour of a city. And over, if you look at the left, you see the town hall. Now, that was all to answer the question. The question was, what if that dog was a reincarnation? That's very odd. If God decided to put a human soul and ride it and kind of like squidge it in to a dog body, which would be an extremely, excruciatingly uncomfortable... Think about it. If we've just said a human soul can't tolerate being in the mere presence of a cow soul, even for a second, but the second it happens, it will rescind, and that's called spiritual excommunication. If God says it's part of a punishment that I'm going to reincarnate you in a dog, as a divine decree, I'm going to stuff you in there, that's like putting a human being in a pair of trousers and a shirt where the inside are made of nettle stings. It's just so uncomfortable. It just doesn't fit. It's like squishing me in. Have you ever seen these Chinese ladies' shoes from the Ming Dynasty, which are that big? Full adult human being foot, that big. Little blue silk ones. Because they've had their feet bound as girls. They literally totter about like this. And their feet are this big. That's really uncomfortable. I mean, I would assume that's really, really uncomfortable. It's not, okay, you say, well, they got used to it. Let's go. The point is that doesn't fit. If you put your foot in one of those, you'll be like, I can shoe all and now you've got to get it in. It's a horrible experience. That's an exception to the rule. If such a thing would happen, then it's going to disassociate. It's only there to fulfill a certain component. Another point to your question is, not all of these spheres are reincarnated. You said, let's say a person's reincarnated into a dog. Not all of these spheres may require reincarnation. Maybe only one of them. Now, that's a subcomponent of reincarnation which we've not discussed. But actually, reincarnation could be like, look, if I got six elements here and only one element is faulty, I'll throw that element back in the mix, fix it up, and then put it back. And it's only that element that rides, as it were, an animalistic component if and when that were to happen. But that, as you can imagine, would be a horrendously unpleasant experience for any human element to be involved with an animal. Do you understand that? This, by the way, is also, to a certain extent, why the rules of bestiality exist, okay, which is also punishable by death. Notice the angel, when it confronted Bilam on the donkey, killed the donkey, right? Because the punishment for bestiality is the animal and the person must die. And Bilam had a relationship with that donkey. In fact, the donkey alluded to that in its discussion to Bilam and said, have I done anything to you before? I'm your donkey, right? I'm your she-donkey, right? So the angel said, that, you know, had you not had a mission, I'd have killed you and let it live. A very, very interesting concept. It's the same concept. That mix doesn't work. Do you understand? It doesn't work. It's the same concept here with these soul elements don't mix together with animals. Does that make sense? Is everyone comfortable with everything? Clive, you've got a question.
You talk about the Maasai. You're referring to the Jewish soul versus the non-Jewish soul. So are these levels?
Yes.
Are they just for the?
They are relevant to Jew and Gentile. The difference is what they connect to. The top levels of a Jewish soul are plugged into one area, and the top levels of a Gentile soul are plugged into another. Both Jews and Gentiles have free will. And they function and they've got their job to do. The Gentiles have the seven Noahide laws to fulfill, and the Jews have the 613 mitzvahs to fulfill. That's how it works. It's how they're rigged. And that's incredible, because during the Geras procedure, there's a re-rigging spiritually. Okay? Any other questions up until that point?
Does a Jew ever come back as a
non-Jew? Wow. In some places we see a woman sometimes comes back as a man. There is a place I could look up. Generally, we don't. Well, would you as a Jew come back? That's a very. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm getting a very important question here. Can a Jew ever be reincarnated as a Gentile? And can a Gentile ever be reincarnated as a Jew? Now, the truth is that it depends how you define Jew. There's two ways to define a Jew. You can either say it's actually spiritual, which we've never discussed before, based upon what these top areas are plugged into. Or you can say, frankly, it only is from the Mount Sinai experience where everyone accepted a code of law and anyone from there is Jewish. Now, we do know that certain people who lived before Mount Tara were reincarnated as people after Mount Tara. Now, does that mean they were originally Gentile and then they become Jewish? That's a fascinating debate and topic, but it is beyond the scope of what we're talking about now. That's more of a reincarnation question, which is to be dealt with later. So please hold that question. What I'm trying to get through very, very clearly is that the souls, human souls, have a discrete, clearly defined, absolutely circumscribed and labellable anatomy. And that is above and beyond the physical bottom line of what body we're in, whether we're male or female or whatever, you know, ethnicity we may come from physically. Above that, there is a Jewish soul and a non-Jewish soul which inhabits human bodies. And that's different from animalistic souls. Going back to the bloke who emailed in and said, can I say Kaddish over my dog? Bottom line is, when a dog dies, it's an animated clod of earth. It reunites with the earth. There's no upper elements which are going to be warehoused where the Kaddish would make any sense. But if he wanted to give tzedakah, I'd always tell him to give tzedakah. Now, he can't say Le'ilui Nishmas is dog, because there is no Nishmas, there's no Neshama. There's only Le'ilui Nefesh Bahamis. So you can only say Le'ilui Nefesh, right? that's like saying Le'ilui any other piece of physicality. But if he wants to use a dock, he keeps a dock if he wants. It's a good thing, it's a merit for him. But he certainly can't say Kaddish over it. He can't say Kaddish because there's nothing to say Kaddish over. It doesn't have those upper elements.
So which elements survive the body when the body dies?
That's an ex Ruach Neshama Chaya Yechida.
Not
the Nefesh Asichlis, not the Nefesh Bahamas, not the Guf.
And not the Ruach, the spirit of speech either.
I said Ruach. Ruach Neshama, Chaya, Yechida. They're spiritual.
They're the soul that we talk about when a person dies.
No, well, yes, when a person dies, quite right. The soul that we talk about is all the way down to Nefesh Bahamas.
Yeah, but when a person dies...
Right, there's a genetic... Right, what's important to know from a Jewish framework is what you got from tonight, so far, is really important to know. A soul comprises of a genetic element and a spiritual element. Now that, of course, fits because we are genetic creatures and spiritual creatures simultaneously. So too, the soul bits have genetic physical components and spiritual components. And the two are stuffed together in a most unnatural coupling, which is extremely uncomfortable for the spiritual element, but very beneficial for the physical element. Is that making sense? Does that?
Say it again.
It's extremely uncomfortable and restrictive for something which is spiritual and not bound by the boundaries, the circumscribed levels of a physical thing, to stuff something spiritual in that. It's very much like a lampshade. If you have a very bright halogen lamp and you put that in a lampshade, the light that comes out of it will be the spiritual element that we're talking, the light. What is light? Photons bouncing around. But that light is now constricted within a shade which is occluding, masking the actual light which is in it. The thicker the lampshade, the more coarse the lampshade, the more it will occlude. If you made the lampshade out of a terracotta pot, you put in a really like million candle power bulb, you wouldn't see anything. If you like had a pot and then you just turned it on, it'd be a very, very slight glow from the top and the bottom. But that's it, you wouldn't know, wouldn't it? But if you made a lampshade out of glass, pure crystalline borate silicate glass, which they use in telescopes, which doesn't, it's totally, totally optically perfect, as much as you can get, you'd see the light as if it's Adam's body prior to the skin was made of ore. Adam's body post the skin was made of ore. It's just the letters changed. Ore with an aleph. Aleph vav resh means light. Ayin vav resh, pronounced exactly the same way, means liver. Or and or. That's it. Now notice that aleph is more guttural. Really, a proper pronunciation of an aleph should be ah. Ah. Well, aleph is just ah. An iron should be ah. So it's ah. It's more guttural. It's more physical. It comes from, you know what I mean? One of the things we do at Havdalah is we look at our fingernails. We have a tradition that Adam was shown how to create fire, Motzi Shabbos, with a flint. God withheld that because fire is an extraordinarily potent element. Did Chazal say that all warfare involves the element of fire? Fire is very dangerous. So he waited for Adam to mature a little bit before we actually showed him that right at the beginning. And Motzi Shabbos, we look specifically at our fingernails and the reflection of the Havdalah candle in the fingernails. Why the fingernail? The fingernail is a covering of the flesh, except it's transparent. Our sages teach us that Adam's body wasn't covered in flesh originally. It was covered in articulated nail. The whole body was nail. There was no flesh under it. Right now, when you look at your fingernails, you'll see the nail bed underneath the nail, which is the pink flesh. And at the back of the nail, by there's like a moon by the cuticle, which are the stem cells that are making keratinized layers called fingernail. But actually, you're looking straight through the fingernail down into what was beneath it. Adam didn't have the flesh beneath it. He literally was made up of nail, and you saw the spiritual components, Nefesh Bahamas, working straight through him. You have to understand, if we'd bump into Adam Harishon before the sin, now, he would not look like a human being that we would recognize today. We would think of him maybe as an extraterrestrial or something like that. We'd say he's dead, but that was a human being. But we lost that. That or with an aleph was replaced with an or with an iron became leather, which is what we have now. We have a leathery finish. The difference between leather and or with an aleph is it's opaque. It hides that which is within it. So the lampshade became much, much more coarse and hides the spiritual component that's within it. Is everyone comfortable with what we've said so far? There's a lot of ideas there. Is everyone okay with that? Any questions to clarify what we've said? Craig.
I remember going on a sort of course a couple of years ago where they said that non-Jewish people only have an animal soul.
Well, that's wrong. And a shama?
Yeah, only an animal soul.
Okay, so if they only have an animal soul, then they are actually animals, which can't be true because they have free will and they're higher order creatures and they can speak. So that's clearly what we've just proved. Sorry, for the tape, everyone's... Oh, I always get it. Please repeat the question. I can't hear what someone said and you're just going for the answer. Someone is saying that they once went on a course and they were told that Gentiles, non-Jews, only have an Efesh Bahamas and they don't have an Ashara. We have to conclude from the data which is being presented to us that can't be correct. Because if it was, they wouldn't be able to reason, speak, make decisions and have any free will. And Gentiles, therefore, wouldn't be given the seven Noahide laws, which are mitzvahs for them, if they didn't have free will. So they have to have free will, otherwise they wouldn't be tested. A mitzvah for the Gentiles is the seven Noahide laws. Mitzvahs for the Jews are Tariq mitzvahs. They have their mitzvahs, they have their Torah they learn. We have our Torah that we learn. If they only had a Nefesh Bahamas, God didn't burden dogs with mitzvahs. We have no tradition that God revealed himself on a big mound somewhere to all dogs and offered the famous dog Torah, where they were not allowed to bury bones on Thursdays. And they had to give mice from their bones to less to more needy dogs. And they couldn't persecute poodles for having such bad haircuts. And they weren't allowed to wear green and grey. And they must go for walks and they mustn't walk backwards. And there's special mitzvahs for dogs. And the dog has to think, should I give part of my bone to Charlie? I hate Charlie's guts. But what can I do? This is a free will decision. Charlie, what should I do? You know what? I'm going to be a good dog. Do a mitzvah. Hey, Charlie, take the bone. Charlie goes, oh, thanks so much. That's really good of you. Bing, I just got a mitzvah. And oh, my God. It doesn't work on other dogs. Dogs aren't challenged like that because they have free will. They have free will and they have the Torah. This is what we talked about with extraterrestrials. Extraterrestrials may be extremely more advanced than us, but they don't have free will like us. So the Torah was only given to one nation. It's a very, very large argument. We talked about extraterrestrials. Certainly, Gentiles must have the higher elements, because otherwise they wouldn't have been burdened or saddled or privileged in order to have the higher thing to work towards. They wouldn't get those wages. Doesn't make sense. So if they only had animals, so they couldn't speak, they couldn't have free will, they couldn't make decisions. Ridiculous. They have the mitzvahs. And God will call them to task, as it says in Gemara, Avodah Zarah, Daf Beis, Amud Beis. It says in Tractate, Avodah Zarah, page 2, folio side B. Where God will say, no, he wants to take accounting from the Gentiles. The Gentiles will have to say, yeah, we did this, this, and this, and God will speak to them about it. How can there be an accounting? He doesn't take accounting from dogs and fish. So, right, guys, let's bring them in. Salmon, would you really say you tried so hard at that waterfall? Well, I was tired and my friend wanted to play a game at the bottom and I thought maybe I should go to the waterfall. But I thought, there's no accounting. They just run the salmon program. The lackadaisical criminal salmon at the bottom who are running a betting thing about which bear's going to eat who. That stupid bear. He's going to get those bears up there. We'll stay here. We won't get eaten. And they talk about each other. There's bears. Oh, he got Charlie. Charlie number six. There's lots of Charlies. So you have to have 6, 7, 8, 9, you know what I mean? It doesn't happen like that, clearly. So clearly, from what we've learned about here, that's an impossibility. Whether or not that's what they said, or that's what you heard, whatever it is, certainly like statement must be concluded as false. Do you feel comfortable with how we've answered that? It must be the case.
Very comfortable.
I'm very glad you're comfortable. Yeah.
Why don't animals have the opportunity for reward and therefore be
known? Why don't animals have the opportunity for reward and free will? And the answer to that is very clearly, because animals were created as a means to an end, not an end in itself. Were you here when we did the Wolves of Yellowstone Park? No. The point is that the whole world is a very complicated place that needs everything in it to make it perfectly balanced. We're just starting to wake up to that fact as human beings with the concept of environmentalism, the biosphere, animal conservation. We're just starting to figure out we may not know why exactly that insect exists. But if we don't have that, we'll have that flower. If we don't have that flower, we won't have honey. We don't have those kind of trees, we won't have those kind of birds that live in those kind of trees. And it's a system. The whole world, everything in the Milky Way, all aliens, the sun, stars, matter, gravity, leeches, mosquitoes, everything was created specifically to be a platform, an arena, for human beings to be able to make free will decisions. It was not created for dogs. Dogs are created for humans. One way or another. Not specifically directed to be man's best friend or something like that. They've got to fulfill their function in the universe. By that fulfilling their function, they make a very complicated patterned plethora of a background so that a human being can operate within that environment based upon the mitzvahs or challenges that come his or her way.
Sorry.
Yes.
I don't.
This is the last question I'm taking on this bit.
I don't understand why an extraterrestrial hasn't got free will. If a Gentile has got free will, and an extraterrestrial living in Andromeda is an extraterrestrial Gentile, and if he says, should we visit planet Sol, should we visit Sol or should we visit Alpha Centauri? No, let's go to Sol. That's free will. He's deciding.
No, it's not free will because there's no mitzvah or avari involved. He can make decisions as to what he wants to wear, what he wants to have.
Decisions and
that's correct. When you put on your shoes, you probably wasn't a free will decision. It was a decision that this shoe's the most comfortable. Coffee and tea, we've discussed this previously. Coffee and tea, I think you were there for that. Coffee and tea, like whether or not I like coffee or tea, that's not a free will decision. Especially which one gives me more pleasure. Free will must always involve an avera and or a mitzvah. Okay. And those creatures have not been given the Torah. So without their Torah, which is the seven Achad laws, or the full Torah, they cannot have full free will. They may have a semblance of free will. Some say they have one pasuk, or some claim that they have one pasuk. Whatever they've got, we have 5,845 pasukim. So a lot more than one pasuk. And that's if they have any verses at all. So what they have is absolute great, great mind power, greater than ours, let's say. But we learn out that actually part of human development is part and parcel for them. We'll learn out how space travel later is actually part, why space travel is a very necessary element of human development that we're going to need because of the human proliferation of space and why God wants that. But that's something for a later talk. That's very exciting to talk about. That's mentioned in here, talked about, and it's a fascinating concept, but it is off topic for what we're doing now. Is everyone comfortable about what we've done so far? That's pretty intense, no? Yeah. So coming right to me, I'm going to answer your question. If I can, I did say it was the last question. The beginning of the very, very beginning when we walked in here, God is my neshama. My neshama is a bit of God. Falsehood. God can't have bits. He has no anatomy. He has no anatomy, no component parts. The soul has six, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 clear component parts. And actually, what we've done here is known as gross anatomy. That's like me saying, head, torso, legs. Now, if you really want to get into it, you can spend months just looking at the anatomy of a foot. Just ask your local podiatrist. They, like, all the muscles, there's a lot to learn on anatomy, right? Very specific, right? Inset points of different muscles, tendons, and ligaments, whether they abduct, retract, how they work. Just so too in the soul, there are specific bits. These circles are actually very complicated machines, each one of them. The fact that there's complexity and structure automatically gates the fact that it can have anything to do with God. God has no structure and no complexity. When the Torah talks about and God with a biyad rama, with an outstretched arm and his breath, etc., Rashi always says it's talking with ears to hear. We have to explain things in a way that we can understand it. Now remember, I don't know if you were here when I talked about, imagine if I was going to try to talk to people who only lived in a two-dimensional world. And I was trying to say, now they don't have tops, they don't have lids. And I can peer into their internal organs because they don't have any height, don't have length and breadth. And they literally live in a totally 2D world. And I, who have 3D, I go, hello, hello. They wouldn't be able to hear or perceive me because I have height, breadth and depth. Do you understand? Now, they aren't going to be, their eyes are flat. When I'm talking, they're saying, well, what do you do? I can't tell them I eat breakfast made of puffed rice or something like that. They're not rice, they don't have farms that grow anything. Nothing can grow. They're totally flat. I would have to speak in a way which they can understand. God is a pan-dimensional being. He invented the concept of dimension. That's why he's obviously invisible. Your eyes can't perceive that which isn't bound by dimension, because the way we do it is through photons hitting the back of a layer and moving chemicals through the back, which turn into electricity, then an impulse into our brain, which makes sense of it all. That isn't going to be able to capture something in another dimension. That's why you can't see extra-dimensionally, let alone outside of the concept of dimension. So when I'm going to talk to these guys, I kind of say, listen, I'm doing what you would call breakfast. But that's, do you understand? God doesn't, if he had breath, that means he'd have to have lungs. If he has lungs, he'd have to have his diaphragm. If he has a diaphragm, then he has to have the torso. If he has a torso, he's got to have a musculature. And we know that he can't have that. Because if he does, he's imperfect. Because he's limited and bound by those systems. And we know he's devoid of any possible deficiency. Do you feel comfortable with that answer? Craig had his hand up. Yes, Craig, is your question still going?
I think it's outside your bell. Speaking up on the question about extraterrestrials.
Oh, that's outside the bell. Sorry. Yeah, okay. I'm sorry, I want to answer, but...
It's a good question.
I'm sure it's a brilliant question, but there's lots of great questions out there, and I've got to... You know what I mean? Okay, so another good question is, what... Yeah.
The top two, Yukida and Fire.
Yes.
What's the nature, though? You've not really spent...
No, I haven't. Very good. I haven't... Right, the question is, what's going on with the Chaya and Yukida, which are in the upper worlds? The Chaya is the life force of the Neshama. It's almost like the Nefesh Bahamas is to the Guf. That's really out there. You think about that. My consciousness, how's that really animating my flesh and my muscles? That's kind of crazy. That's very, very ethereal. The Chaya is the consciousness of the soul. And the Echida is the unique processes, mental conscious processes, which are identifying that Chaya from other Chayas. Very, very, very abstract. So abstract, they have nothing to do with you in any form of practical way. Obviously you need them. It's wiring somewhere down the road. That's like when you go to get your money at the ATM machine, that's one guy's decision on a board meeting whether they should invest in conglomerates. What do you care? There's lots of £10 in the machine. How can you have your discussion about conglomerates or futures? That's the Chaya Yechida. We're going to talk about what they're plugged into later.
And where do they reside?
Where do they reside? That's an interesting question. They're actually plugged in. The top of the Yechida is actually plugged into the Koichos, the primordial forces in the world of creation, beyond that of the angels.
No,
they're completely not associated with the body whatsoever. We'll talk about that. That's why. Do you remember? Sorry, I'm going off a little bit. Do you remember what I said that a Jew and a Gentile, they do an Aveira mitzvah? It's totally different. If a Jew does an Aveira, he pushes Shechina, he pushes divine presence out the world. If a Jew does a mitzvah, he pulls Shechina into the world. Mm. Well, it doesn't work like that with Gentiles. Why? Because we're actually part and parcel of the Koichos. It's a system. It's a system. We'll talk about that. Okay? Gosh, that was really intense! Okay, this is the last question. Can I skip that question? So, is this question on topic?
Yeah.
Okay.
Where are the other elements? Like, in the Shama Ruach Nefesh, are they, like, inside the brain?
Excellent. Where's the Neshama? Answer that. The Rambam, who died over 1,000 years ago, said that the Neshama only attaches to the body when you do a mitzvah these days. He said, we're on such a low level, the Neshama only comes in when you're doing mitzvah, all ne'ila at Yom Kippur. Let me show you something. I'm looking at a person who's sitting down. Jack, are you in your shoes?
What?
Just yes or no? It's a yes-no question.
Yeah.
Yes, you're in your shoes. But when I'm looking at him, I can't see him in his shoes. What does it mean you're in your shoes? It means... Now listen, this is really important. I've got to do this. While I'm here, I've got to do this. How does a neshama exert an influence on the body? I'm in my shoes, right? You're in your shoes. Everyone in the room, unless they've kicked off their shoes while I can't see them, are in their shoes. Now, what does that mean? What is a shoe? It's really important. A shoe is a device that we slip into to interface with the filth of the gutter. Now, think about that. It's vital. It's a device that our bodies require
to slip into to keep the body clean and safe, and then we allow the bottom of the shoe especially to go anywhere. We'd step in anything. But I wouldn't put my hand in that. And I certainly wouldn't stuff my face in it either. It's true, it sounds crazy, but it's obvious. It's obvious. The sole of the shoe is the bit of my physicality which I'm happy to basically put in pretty much anything. Even that which is squeezed out of a dog. Right, think about it. But you wouldn't put your nose in that. Now, our sages teach us that the soul, the neshama, dips into the body like a body dips into a shoe. The soul utilizes the body as a shoe to interface with the filth of this world. The body, which I have symbolized as a tray, which is actually a shoe, is the thing which actually interfaces with stuff. The neshama ain't going to do it. The neshama's way too lofty to get involved. It's just, I don't touch that. You touch that. I'm telling you to touch that. I'm telling you, don't touch that. Now, where is the neshama? The neshama dips into the body at the area of the fontanelle. But that's just the foot of the neshama. I said that these bits have anatomy. The neshama has a foot area. A foot area, known as a podocyte in Latin. A pod in Latin is the word for foot. A podocyte is like a tendril which comes out foot-like into something. The neshama has a foot. That foot clicks into the very tippy top of the cerebral cortex, which is the top of the grey matter, and influences the thoughts of man or woman. Mainly, though, the thoughts of the man or woman come from Nefesh HaBahamis and Nefesh HaSichlis, which explains why extraterrestrials decide to go to Sol or Alpha Centauri. Because that's an experience there of like a dog deciding, let's go and sniff that lamppost. But the higher element, the neshama, which says, F shall she put on tefillin. And the body says, no, I don't do that. Well, I'm telling you, it's a really good idea. That's a mitzvah! Uh-oh, tussle between the neshama, which has a spiritual agenda, versus the body and Nefesh Bahamas, which has a physical agenda. All the body wants, and all the Nefesh Bahamas wants, is physical repose. Physically, it wants a foot massage, it wants a pina colada by a swimming pool in an exotic location. All day, every day, until it dies. That's it. Sounds good to me. And that's the body saying, great! Because the body wants to be involved in physical things. The soul wants to be involved in spiritual things. And they're at a tussle. And that tussle point generates the free will. The body is the Yetzer Hara. The neshama is the Yetzer Tov. The body is the inclination to evil. The neshama is the inclination to good. That tussle is what we call Bechira only at the point of conflict. Bechira is only at the conflict point. The foot of the soul delves into the body at the top of the brain. And the rest of it kind of hovers outside. At a point of now, it should be like that all the time. But we've become, notice, we used to wear tefillin all day. Jewish men would wear tefillin from the time they got up until night time. Then they would take off their tefillin, go about their business. So you'd see a carpenter, he'd be wearing tefillin. You'd see a bricklayer, he'd be wearing tefillin. Today we are considered to be on such a low level that we cannot mentally maintain our focus to the prerequisite level of sanctity required to be able to wear what is second only in sanctity to a Torah scroll on our bodies. We can't nullify the mitzvah. We would technically nullify and say, don't wear them at all. But what can we do? The Torah said we've got to wear them. So you wear them at the time of the morning prayers, and then take them off. Some extremely elevated individuals, in Jerusalem especially, tend to wear them all day and only take them off at night. That is only ever done on the very watchful eye of the Rosh Yeshiva and stuff like that. These people, there are some people that do that. It's very, very rare. But it's not totally unheard of. It certainly would be unheard of in places like Whitefield. So don't do it. Okay, it would be the wrong thing to do. But that's why we take off tefillin. We should really leave them on. Nowadays, the neshama only dips in
at a mitzvah point, and that was 1,000 years ago, says the Rambam, or specifically at Ne'ilah, the climax of Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the year. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
This is, okay, what have we got from today? Let's do a little bit of a summary. What's going on, okay? One of the things on the poster was the anatomy of the human soul, okay? What have we got here? The human soul is an absolutely defined, discrete thing. It's an engine made up of subparts, yeah? They're defined, they have names, they have parts, they have components, they have jackpots, they work together. Those bits are all defined in our Jewish sources. An animal only has the lowest element, what we would call a soul, which is nefesh bahamas, nefesh sichlis. You can't say kalasho for a dog, because it's just an animated clod of earth. Everyone cool with that so far? At least from what we understand in this material. Believe what you want and stuff like that. This is what the source we're going to see inside stuff like that. It's very, very clear, right? There are 6 levels to the human soul, and each one of them is so refined that each level finds the next level down abhorrent. Abhorrent. It had nothing to do with it. Yeah? Each of these elements has a specific function, and together the entire chain, as a shalsheles, like a chain, functions as one thing, a unit, that we call a soul. Part of which is actually genetically encoded in our bodies. Now, each of them have different functions. They have completely different functions. They function different things that all must be working together perfectly, like a body or a machine, to have output. What we're going to talk about next time is what those functions are, how we are affected by that in our daily lives, what we can do to enhance or reduce the effectivity, efficaciousness of that, and what spiritual things we're able to tap into supernaturally because we are connected to these things. If you know what to do and press the buttons, you should be able to tap into a supernatural level of power and order, which we can do through the human spirit, both Jew and Gentile. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. It's been a real honour to be able to address you on this. I hope to see you next time. Mm-hmm.